Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. You ever been in analysis?
No, I haven't. No. Right. Some people have thought that I should have been.
My next guest knows an awful lot about it. Uh-huh. And she has written a novel covering some of the world that she's explored in some of her other books, which have, including Sins of the Mother and The Last Good Freudian. Her new book is a novel called Vienna Triangle, and it involves the triangle of Freud, Helene Deutsch, Tausk, and Lou Andrea Salome, described as serial muse to Nietzsche, Rilke, and Freud. All sorts of triangles. Many. Please welcome Brenda Webster to West Coast Live. Thank you very much for coming in.
Hi, nice to be here.
You grew up in a household where analysis was sort of de rigueur.
Yes, my grandmother was in analysis in 1925. I think she was one of the very first. And not only that, but my mother was in analysis at the same time as my grandmother. And they both fell in love with their analysts, and there was a triangle for you right away.
Same analyst?
Yes, same analyst. And my mother was very, very beautiful, and she was so enamored of this man that she frightened him into going back to Vienna to have a reanalysis by Freud because he couldn't cope with these two women.
So this strikes me as a rich material for a writer.
Very, very rich, yes.
The other thing about analysis that strikes me is it's something for well-to-do people to do.
Well, my family was well-to-do. Yes, my grandmother unfortunately lost all her money because she was, after my grandfather died, she was in love with what she thought was a German baron. And on their wedding night, she signed over her considerable fortune. And the next day, he was gone.
Wow.
So that was that.
But your family, nevertheless, practices. And you, I get the sense from your other writings, have sort of doubts about the practice.
Yes, I came after 20 years being a psychoanalytic critic, writing about Yeats and Blake from a psychoanalytic point of view, I got extremely skeptical and suddenly realized that I had been wasting my life on the couch, being on the couch for... My mother had been in analysis for 30 years.
Was this a daily?
5 times a week, or sometimes on the weekends she'd have to drive out to the... She was being analyzed by Mariana Criss, who was the analyst of Marilyn Monroe, and she didn't do too well there, and she didn't. And she was a wonderful analyst, I think. It wasn't so much her fault.
But the focus of the analysis, I mean, was this the talking cure? And although the talking cure is often described with analysis, somebody else other than Freud came up with the phrase talking cure.
No, I'm trying to remember... Who did, and I can't.
Was it Tausk? It wasn't Tausk.
No, it wasn't Tausk. Oh, it was, I think, the first patient that Breuer had.
Oh, Breuer.
Yes, came up with that. And she found that if she did this cobweb sweeping every day of all the things that were in her mind, she felt better. And so it became called the talking cure.
And so out of this has grown... enormous field of psychotherapy of one kind or another. You take us back to the beginning in this novel through the eyes of a woman named Kate who is trying to understand not only her own family, but the role of women, what role women played in influencing Freud, whether Freud was scared of women, whether he tried to suppress them, take their ideas.
Yeah, well, Kate is sort of a stand-in for me because at that age I was getting my doctorate at Columbia. And she is working there in psychology. And she stumbles on the mystery of Tausk's death. Tausk was one of Freud's disciples, his most brilliant, some would say. And yet I bet nobody's heard. How many people have heard of Victor Tausk? No. So the point is that after he was relied on to teach Freud's courses in theory at the hospital in the early days. And when he killed himself... under sort of suspicious circumstances. He both hung and shot himself, and I always said one was for Freud.
That's kind of a belt and suspenders kind of thing.
It, It's really, and some people said he castrated himself as well. But I don't think
that wasn't for Freud, or that was.
They said if he hadn't done that, Freud would have done it for him.
And it's charming people.
Yeah. So it's really a very awful but fascinating situation how Freud was involved in this. Lou Salome was the lover of Tausk, this brilliant philosopher, German philosopher, sort of the most brilliant woman of her day, and Freud was jealous, in my opinion, and not because he wanted to, he probably did want to sleep with her, he wouldn't have though, but he wanted all her attention and Tausk took it away. And so when Tausk was very, very upset and wanted to be analyzed, Freud refused to analyze him. And there was no one else suitable to do it. And he gave Tausk to a younger colleague, Helena Deutsch, who incidentally was my mother's analyst. Then after a few months, he said, you know, this isn't working, because she was being analyzed by Freud at the same time as she was analyzing Tausk. And he said, so either you continue with me or you drop Tausk. She, of course, dropped Tausk, because what would she have done? She was completely reliant on him for patients. And 3 months later, or sometime after, Tausk killed himself. So it was really a fascinating story. And the involvement of the women, the way they couldn't resist. I mean, my little heroine, she's age of my daughter now, was really, and I lost that.
Oh, sorry. One of the things that you talk about is this theory that I was unaware of, that Freud believed that women are masochistic.
Oh, yeah, he did. He thought that was one of the foundations of a woman's personality, passivity, masochism, and penis envy, were the three things that characterized a woman. And my heroine, of course, is upset. She's almost a feminist.
It's set in 1968, I should say.
Set in the late 60s, but goes back to the early days. You know, so there are two plots, one going in the present and one in the past. And she is, of course, horrified at the idea of masochism. And she gets to interview Helena Deutsch, who's now 85, about why she was such a proponent of masochism. And it turned out that she really wasn't such a proponent of masochism. She wouldn't disagree with Freud publicly, but that in her, when she had patients, as she says, if someone was, their husband was betraying them and they were just spending their time mopping the floor, she would say, get off your knees. Your husband deserves to be in the dirty water, not you. And go get a job and do something interesting. So she was actually very supportive of women, but she did it in a way which wouldn't annoy Freud. And the women had to do that. And my heroine finds out that the woman she sort of idealizes, Helena Deutsch, actually had to sort of be female in the sense of maneuvering around his commandments.
Freud's ideas were certainly profound and provocative throughout the 20th century. I mean, do you think they'll continue to hold weight in the 21st century?
I'm wondering about it, because certainly there's been so much criticism lately. And I would imagine that in terms of treatment, that it's already, I mean, they're much shorter treatments. The young analysts, particularly the young women analysts, you know, are very much more engaged with their patients and less standoffish. I think as treatment, it didn't work. And Freud, I'm now writing a play about Freud, but the more I look into it, he didn't believe in treatment either. He said the least interesting part was the treating the patients. The most interesting part was inventing new theories and using them as, you know, sort of guinea pigs for the theories.
So in some ways, I mean, he was actually a kind of a scientist. I mean,
yes. Yes, I think that's right. He was fascinated with the architecture of the theory that he was building. And he even told Helena Deutsch, don't waste too much time on some people. If they're just hopeless, forget it, you know.
So you also make a point about the idea, the notion of genius, that genius is somehow, can excuse really awful behavior, or at least, you know, can be set apart from the awful behavior.
Well, I don't think so personally, but one of my analysts, Kurt Eisler, who was head of the Freud archives, felt that genius could excuse or explain certain behavior. He wrote two books defending Freud in about this Tausk thing. One called, I think, Genius and Talent, and with the specific argument that genius was different. Different
than talent.
Yes, and that, you know, so what talent did had to be judged as neurotic. What genius did was part of his greatness.
So in a way, we're just talking labeling, in a way, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so. And my mother thought she was a genius, so this had resonance for me because she even created a paradise where she would be truly, she was a painter, would be truly recognized. She was recognized. She had paintings in museums and so on, but not enough for her. So she felt that after she died, she would go to this special paradise where there'd be Marie Curie and Einstein and, you know, a few other people like that. André Gide, she did portraits of the people that were going to, of course, I wasn't going to be with her. So it all.
That's interesting that you could create your own heaven of who you want your peers to be there. Your father was an entertainment lawyer, and among his clients were the Marx Brothers.
That's right. He had Lillian Hellman, the Marx Brothers, all kinds of fascinating people, and was always in the news.
And at one point he jumped out naked at a Marx Brothers party from a cake.
That was the room. You know, that's the story that was.
What would Freud say about that?
I don't know. Don't know, but it must have been fun. I wish I'd been there.
As you've explored this material, both sort of through a biography and memoir and novel, I mean, have you gotten to the, you know, some kind of root, some sort of base clarity for you?
Well, actually, I'm now doing a play with a producer in New York about Freud, and the more I look into it, and I thought I'd looked into it plenty, the more sort of unpleasant things I'm finding about the character of the founder, Freud. I'm not sure I'm getting to clarity, but I'm certainly getting, I reread some of the cases, like Emma Eckstein, where his friend had a theory that everything, that the nose represented the genital. So if you had different organic problems, to operate on the nose would cure your problems and Freud went along with this, and they operated on this poor woman's nose and took out her turbinate bone, which I gather is like holds up the whole of the nose. So when they took it out, her nose later actually collapsed and she was deformed for life. And then she came back after the operation. She was bleeding, and I just wrote a scene about this, and all full of pus. And he said that she was having a hysteria attack. And it turned out that that Fleece, his friend who did the operation, had left all the gauze in her nose and it was infected. And so, I mean, these things, you read these and think, could this really happen? This sounds so surreal.
But it did. I mean, those things happen. I mean, you know, I was interested, there was a phrase you use here, even the psychoanalysts, who back then were often brilliant but always quirky, were becoming bland technicians of the spirit.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a nice phrase.
I think it came from you, actually.
Yeah, it did. Oh, well. Yeah, well, they've sort of tamed down. You don't find these very, very over-the-top eccentric people anymore that, you know, lock people in organ boxes and did various things.
When you talk about, there's a description of Tausk here, Helene Deutsch says, Freud thought of him as a predator, but she saw him more as a berserker, a warrior with a soft heart, a suffering fellow creature. Brudertier?
Brother animal. Lou Salome thought of Tausk as a fellow creature. That's what she meant by brother animal. But Freud, because Freud set Tausk to attack other people like Jung and Adler, who were defecting from his movement in the early days, Freud had all these sort of son-like people who would then rebel and be teenage sons and go off and start their own movements. And Tausk was set to attack them. However, then Freud became very anxious that if he had the capacity, as he said, to bark and bite, he would then turn on Freud himself. And since he had invented the Oedipus complex, that every son wanted to turn on his father and kill him, of course, all his sons, his disciples, were also going to kill him. So it was sort of a catch-22. He had to imagine that everybody wanted to do him in.
He sounds paranoid.
He had a paranoid streak. He even thought Tausk really wanted to kill him. And Anna Freud apparently bought into it and thought that Tausk somehow had an apartment near where Freud was, and he could, you know, was having the apartment so that he could do some dastardly thing, and which was really absolutely not true at all. Freud also thought Tausk was reading his mind. And I have a video on Red Room where I show this by having Freud, a picture of Freud, and then Tausk's head moving through his head, which I think is a neat visual effect.
There's a cake has a little role in your book. Whenever sort of Helene and Kate are getting together, there's cake, you know, whether Kate wants to have cake or doesn't want to have cake, and whether Helene thinks that Kate really wants to have a piece of cake, and then Kate decides to order letter Kate. I just thought, what is it about the significance of ordering cake? I mean, is that a symbolic of something in some way?
It's symbolic of my hunger for sweets, but... and it had whipped cream on it, remember?
Yeah, it did.
That's very important.
There was a scene at the Hotel Stanhope, the Stanhope Hotel, which no longer exists. Oh. But I think that the Helene liked going there because it reminded her of old Vienna.
Yeah.
And certainly, I mean, one of the things that you capture in this is sort of the spirit of that old Vienna, the cliquishness, the way that ideas were constantly debated in cafes. You go to a cafe nowadays, people are plugged in on their headphones or on a laptop. But I mean, these were places where politics and ideas were constantly being debated and friendships and enmities being created.
Yeah, Freud had his own cafe that he always went to, and my husband and I, we went to Vienna just to go and eat cake and all the places where Freud ate. So it was very inspiring.
Wanted to consume pieces of Freud, I can see that.
Yeah.
And World War One. I mean, plays a significant role, of course, in the shifting fortunes of these people's lives.
Well, it was very important because that's where they started getting the shell-shocked soldiers back into war by giving them some talking therapy. And in fact, Tausk, the one I'm so enamored of, wrote several things about war neuroses, and he served for 2 years in the war and wrote very interesting things about, for instance, he defended peasants would go back to their land in the middle of the battle, and because they had to reap or sow. And he would explain to the people who were going to execute the peasants that peasants did not have an idea of the state, and therefore when their crops were ready, they thought they should go back and tend them. And so he was quite anti-war way before his time. And my heroine's boyfriend is also anti-war in Vietnam. So we have a parallel of this man who turns out to have a close relation to my heroine's family, but that's kind of happens along the way.
There's also Kate reflects on the attitudes of sexuality of of 1968, comparing them with the attitudes of sexuality of the turn of the other century, and finds that people were just as randy then.
Oh yeah, even more. I mean, the things that were going on are quite fantastic with these triangles and these, you know, various things and. Also, Freud would interfere in people's marriages. He would tell when someone would go away to try to have another analyst analyze them so that they could get away from him. He would say, "I don't want this marriage disturbed." He would write to the analyst, "Don't disturb this marriage." So,
what do you think we should take away about Freud nowadays?
Well, I do think there are unconscious impulses towards things. And that noticing, for instance, that you behave in the same way to your boss as you did to your father or with your father or mother or whatever, those things can be very helpful. And, you know, there's still things that could be helpful if they were used correctly.
So a large part of this was trying to understand our impulses, our animal impulses, our basic, our emotional impulses, and then to apply an intellectual construct over it in some way. And you think that Freud got his intellectual construct just a little askew.
Well, I think actually that Breuer, who started out the talking cure, was much more collaborative with his first patient than Freud later was. Freud had this very authoritarian stance, which I think now people are not using. And so a lot of that had to go. And yet some of the things about the unconscious, repetition of different things, not realizing what you're doing, and, you know, a lot of things can be still useful.
It's a fascinating novel. It's called Vienna Triangle. Lovely picture of a couple. Not three people,
that's
there's two embracing. It's a Klimt, yes, I know
Vienna.
It's Klimt.
Yeah,
I know he's from Vienna.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right. You know, he wore this blue gown. Have you ever seen that blue gown that he would paint in?
No, I didn't.
Oh, there's a, and you can get replicas of it at that museum in New York City near the Guggenheim.
Oh, the wonderful, we were just...
Neue Gallery.
Yeah.
Neue Gallery.
Yeah.
And I figured because he always apparently slept with his models... It was like very easy to get on and off for him.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's a new bit of information.
There you go. Well, anyway.
Show them the picture. Yeah. Beautiful picture.
Yeah, an embrace. Vienna Triangle by Brenda Webster. Thank you very much for being on West Coast Live.
Thank you, Seth.
Thank you. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.